Welcome to Practical Theology, a podcast series by Battle Creek Friends Church. Our hope is that by listening, you feel equipped in your faith to speak out in confidence about what you believe and live it out. We're here to help you seek the Lord throughout your day. So here's your host, Bible teacher, father, husband, and guy who likes cookies, Leo Wilson.
Hello and welcome to episode 10 of Practical Theology. Today we talk about people and the image of God. So what are people? Over time, man has tried to define himself, and at first, probably the simplest one to start off with is man is a biological life form, specifically a mammal. Some go further. Some say, well, man's not just any mammal. He's a highly evolved mammal, the apex mammal. The opposable thumbs, being able to open doors, work tools. Some might not say mentally, but others would say we've just developed and evolved in a higher mental capacity. Well, that's one way, but just to say man's another mammal, that's not a Christian view for sure. Others define men in other ways, such as maybe by their worth or value. We might sit there and say, well, a man's real essence is to make money, to produce things, to become successful, more of an economic being, have more possessions. You know, he who dies with the most toys still dies, but we could say he had a lot of fun. That's not very gratifying either, to talk about how that life is lived. Some think social being, such as relationships, power, maybe popularity, how much you can impact other people would define what your worth is and the point of man. Well, none of these are satisfying. As a matter of fact, Solomon in Ecclesiastes actually talks about this, whether it was pleasure or money or women, whatever it was that he pursued, they never satisfied him. And I think that's because satisfaction comes from purpose. And the thing that decides purpose is the creator. If you've built any machine, if you've built anything, sewn anything, made anything, if you try to bake a cookie and it's not a cookie, it's not satisfying. And if it's eaten not as a cookie, if it's used as a hockey puck, for example, that wouldn't be incredibly satisfying. Same thing with using a tool. It's much more satisfying to use a tool, such as a hammer, for driving a nail, because that's what it's designed for, than a rock, because a rock isn't designed for that. Now, you might feel great when you pull it off, but that's kind of the point. When you use a rock to hammer a nail, you're like, ah, look what I just did. Right, and you feel great about that because you defied the odds because you know it was crazy to use a rock in the first place. I know in multiple times that I've tried to use a rock, admittedly, I would have swung and it slid off and I dented the board, or I even smashed my finger underneath the rock as I was swinging it. So it's much nicer and much more gratifying when you use something like that for its intended purpose. Along those lines, I think that's important with us. I think when we look at what God has said for us, we find a great amount of gratification. Can you still find pleasure in other things? Sure, all those things I just mentioned, you can find pleasure in, but I don't think that's satisfaction, nor do I think it's satisfaction in a deep level. For example, I think of a dog when I think of this example. Growing up with dogs, man, I remember when I think that dog was the happiest. It was when we were walking out in the woods and he could smell all the different animals and he would be tracking. I just remember the intention that he had, the tail slightly wagging, the point, the determination, you know, and just like very interested, nose to the ground, just sniffing all over the place, breathing heavy, like just so excited. I would liken that to the idea of that's what that dog was partially intended for. Not to be dressed up in a fuzzy sweater and put into a baby stroller. Okay, everything likes to be pampered. I don't disagree with that. But is there the same level of satisfaction? I've never seen a dog in a cart like that as satisfied as I have a dog on the scent of an animal, for example. Well, with that, let's go look and see what God has said about us. So we're going to start in Genesis 1, verse 20. And what I want to see is overall creation. I want to do some comparison. So we're going to read different creation accounts and then get to us. And I want to notice both intentional uses of words as well as notice the duration of time that each one is spent God uses to describe the creation particular, such as the birds of the sky, and how much detail is there. So verse 20, and God said, let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the vault of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living thing with which the water teems and that moves about in it, according to their kinds. and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas and let the birds increase on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning the fifth day. Notice the size of that. That was three verses, four verses with two different creation accounts of sea creatures and flying creatures. And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, the livestock, the creatures that move along the ground, and the wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Notice the relationship there to every creature. We'll get back to that. And God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that the earth has, the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day. Okay, so in that, there's several things I want to point out. The first one is just the quantity of text. I mentioned like the two verses for flying creatures, the two verses for sea creatures, a couple more verses than that for the land animals because it talks about livestock and wild animals and ones that crawl on the ground. But then when he gets to man, it's almost three times the amount of information. And the next point would be is it was very personal. Not only did he give more information, but what type of information? I tried to emphasize like the according to their kind. He created them according to their kind. And they were to produce according to their kind. Those are impersonal statements that he was making. And then when he gets to man, he starts to say, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness. What I want to point out there and why I was emphasizing it is it was a very personal. When it came to man, when it came to male and female, he created them, it was very personal. It was intentional and it was relational. It wasn't just creating in like a indirect fashion where it's like, okay, they're over there, that's them, this is us. When it comes to man, he was very intentional about how they related to him and us. Speaking of possibly the Trinity or the heavenly court, but whatever it was, they were, I would say, partially spiritual in being. And that's significant. The other thing I think is neat is the Hebrew verb bara. This word means to create, and it is used three times in the creation account. And every time it's used, there is a significant jump. There is a significant increase in purpose or level. And it was used, the three different parts are this. In the one, the creation of matter is where that's used. The second one is in the creation of organic life. So when he starts to create there at verse 20, the creation of organic life, it uses that verb. And then once again, when man is created. And you only see that used when it's created by God. So it's always specifically, if you heard that word, you would just assume it's, oh, that's created by God. So it's a very intentional, very purposeful, and I think also powerful word. It's showing that there is a significance whenever that verb is used. So man is more significant than the rest of the creatures, which is more significant than all of the other creation, like the earth, the water, the seas. Like life has significance, human life even more significance. So some challenge this and they say, well, okay, that's great, but the image was lost in the fall. Well, I don't believe that's so. And here's why. We're going to go to Genesis 9:6. And in Genesis 9:6, God is talking to Noah. And he's talking about human life. And listen to what he says here. Whoever sheds human blood, by humans shall their blood be shed. For in the image of God has God made mankind. See, this happens after the fall. So this implies, if God's saying this will happen because of this, that the image is still there. And that goes back to sit there, and we'll talk more about what the image is. But for the point of this, it's important to know that we are always made in his image. It didn't get lost at the fall. If anything happened at the fall, we would say that it was tarnished. We'll talk more about that with some other passages in Scripture. But for now, we just need to know that we are in his image, period. Fall, sin, whatever it is, we are still image people. We are still made in his image. So what would people of that time heard if you would have said like an image or an idol? What would it mean to have something made in an image or an idol? Because God had very specific rules about making idols and not making idols. And foreign cultures had idols to their deities. And when they crafted these things, it wasn't believed that it was just some wood block. And even Scripture kind of makes fun of that idea. What was understood by people of that time was that the little idol carried the essence of the deity. It was somehow not just a representation, but actually possessed something that was worthy. Otherwise, it would just have been a block of wood. So with the same likeness, if he's describing that to us, people could have made this statement of like, well, we are his image bearers. Maybe we're idols. Well, maybe that's one way to look at it, but we wouldn't worship each other. Maybe it's more important to see that we carry part of the essence of what God is. And if you look at that, God created all of the world. He established order by creating the stages of life, but also how the seasons come about and how set things into motion with sun and the moon and the earth. With that, he also challenges us, right? He says, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over it. Some people look at this as a dictatorship, like the statement of like, oh, you're superior, therefore you're going to control it. I think that's a very poor way of looking at it. I think the proper way of looking at it is more of a steward or a manager, a caretaker, maybe the best way. God is actually personally inviting us to be a caretaker with him. He wants us to be involved in this creation, his creation, our creation. We're going to be involved in it, and we're going to take care of it, and we're going to rule over it and subdue it, just like he did by putting things in order, you know, taking chaos and making order out of it, creating life, being a sustainer of life. We're going to help in that process, which makes sense since we are in his likeness and image. It's probably part of our purpose, and that's what he's stating. It is part of our purpose, which is how we would get gratification and satisfaction too. Deep satisfaction is doing what we're intended to do, living out what he's wanted for us. I also think it's interesting in Exodus 20, verse 4, one of the things that God challenges the people not to do is he says, you shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven or above or on earth beneath or in the waters below. You know, it's interesting to God that he says, you shall make no images. But yet, here we are as his image, almost like God is saying, please don't try to do something better than I've done. I've already made an image. I've already made something that's going to represent for me on earth and is going to stand for me on earth, and it's you. Nothing else is going to take your place. You are my special creation. No, also, God doesn't make junk. You know, some people, if you think like, oh, I'm a failure, I suck at life, I have no purpose, this is not true. It does not matter who you are or where you are or what you've done. You have a purpose. You are not junk. God does not create junk. It's absurd to even say such a thing. And even literally, like God didn't create a tin can. Man created a tin can out of tin, right? And then all the junk that is in the garbage heap, nothing there is something that God created. You know, even banana peels break down, but the things that are there are really creations of man. So just, I mean, take that a little bit further. It's just fun to go on that tangent. But really, the point to drive home is God does not create junk. You have worth and purpose. So in Exodus 24, when he says, not make that image, it's because he's already made it. And there's nothing else that needs to take its place. You are to represent him to each other and to all the people on earth, to all the animals on earth, to be the representation and caretaker. Leviticus 26:1 also says, do not make idols or set up an image or a sacred stone for yourselves, and do not place a carved stone in your land or to bow down before it. I am the Lord your God. Another interesting thing about the idea of worshiping it. You know, we shouldn't worship each other, but in one sense, when we worship together at church and when we see other people, we see this idea of what it means to be loved. We see that in personal relationships. As a matter of fact, when Christ came to earth, he's the ultimate image bearer, isn't he? Because he is God. And through that, we saw what it meant to have a godly relationship, to see what it meant to love the sinner, to love each other, to be selfless, to be sacrificing in love. The greatest image bearer of all showed us a lot in that, and also what we have the capacity to do as people. To be made in his image and likeness is almost like being a three-dimensional cavity where you would pour something in it to cast it, almost like a jello mold or for casting steel. And it doesn't mean that the image is there. It means it has the capacity for the image. We'll talk more about this next time about how this looks as far as like what capacity, how far do we go? What does it look like to bear the image of God or even the name of God? But for now, I think that we should just continue down the road of what does it mean to have this image of God? So two more passages to read. Psalm 8, 4 through 9 says this. Psalm 8, 4 through 9. What is mankind that you are mindful of them? Human beings that you care for them? You have made them a little lower than the angels and crowned them with glory and honor. You made them rulers over the works of your hands. You put everything under their feet. All flocks and herds and animals of the wild, the birds in the sky and the fish in the sea, all that swim the paths of the sea. Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. Humans are a little lower than angels and are crowned with glory. Do you see the significance there of who you are? Going back to the idea that you are not junk for sure, but beyond that, you are crowned with glory. You have a glorious purpose, one that is to honor God. Ecclesiastes 7:29 says this, "This only have I found, God created mankind upright, but they have gone in search of many schemes." This idea of upright is interesting. When we talked about the statues and the idols, almost like being the image bearer, this little idol of God, for example. Not that we're supposed to be worshipped. I even hate saying that like that, but for the sake of purpose, imagine sitting there and it says, God created you upright, but they have gone in search of many schemes, almost like it's been knocked over and tarnished. Another reason why I don't think we've lost the image is this kind of imagery where mankind has fallen, but we still have that capacity to honor God. And I think truly we do, whether or not we even want to or not. I think being created in the image of God shows God to everybody, and it also can disrespect him. I think as a person, there's an expectation. There are virtues and values that people, when they look at you, expect you to have, right? And if you don't think that's the case, let's pursue this further with my last example and one of my favorite passages with the image and likeness. It's in Genesis 5:3. And it says this, when Adam had lived 130 years, he had a son in his own likeness. In his own image, he named him Seth. Well, interesting. So God's imagery there, the wording that's used is the same thing that's used when Adam has his own son. It's in his likeness. So that makes me think, okay, how does that apply to me? I have two boys. And I'm like, I do consider them to be in my likeness. Not just they look like me, but I mean, they represent me. Out in the world, if they do something good or something bad, it impacts me. I have expectations of them, and I feel like they represent me. More importantly, maybe even my family. They represent my values. One pastor friend of mine said it when he was raising his two boys, that the verse or phrase he would use a lot is, hey, our family doesn't do that. When he's trying to give them direction on what to do, our family does this. I thought that was great. The idea that the family values are carried by everybody. And if one person creates an issue, it reflects badly on the whole family. This makes sense. When I see my son do something that is shameful, I hurt inside. I'm slightly embarrassed. I don't mean I'm embarrassed because he did that and it's a terrible thing. But like, I mean, part of me inside on a deeper emotional level is saddened by it. At the same point in time when he goes and he prays for somebody or he helps them up or gives them a hug when they're hurt, oh, my heart lifts. I'm so proud of him for doing the right thing. How did I define rights? Go back a couple episodes in Practical Theology. We'll talk about morals, but those virtues and morals that I see him upholding, man, I'm very proud. I'm honored, as a matter of fact, that he is my son, and I think he's bringing honor to me. What does that matter to me? I don't need to be worshipped, but I do want my witness to be counting for something. I do want to honor God, and so when he does that, I believe we are bringing honor to God. We're living a certain way, and I think that is the ultimate satisfaction. Ask yourselves that. Ask yourselves, when you see a family member do something that is a virtue, is honoring of God, is that not a great fulfillment, especially if you have children? Meanwhile, if they do something that would dishonor the family, something that your family wouldn't do, does that just tear you up a little bit inside? Make you want to address it? Maybe make you ask for forgiveness for your family? It totally happens to me. But with all of that, that's exactly what I end every podcast with, is the idea of go and live it out, right? So when we see our children go and live it out, we are so proud. And when they don't, even if they do something omitting it, even if they just don't do the right thing, it's like, oh, well, they didn't do a bad thing, but we still want to see them live it out. We want to see them do the right thing. We want to see them fulfill godly purpose. There's no greater feeling, no greater satisfaction, and nothing greater I want my child to feel than going out and living for God. So until next time, remember, you are disciples at all times. You are showing people all the time about your image, about what's going on in your life, and who you follow. Regardless of whether or not you do it or not, as a person, as a human being, you do represent something more. So until next time, go and live it out.